Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, everyone. Jeremy Scheinwald here with another episode of Smart People Shouldn't Build Things, the Venture for America podcast. Our podcast is produced by Venture for America, a fellowship program for enterprising recent college graduates who launch their careers as entrepreneurs and thus help revitalize American cities. After 5 weeks of training, VFA fellows spend 2 years in the trenches of a startup in an emerging U.S. city, where they learn how to contribute to high-growth businesses. Afterwards, VFA provides the mentorship, network, and resources fellows need to become entrepreneurs. VFA has some notable successes. I'm excited about one, Mike Wilner, who launched Compass, which creates easy-to-build professional websites without the headaches. To learn more about Venture for America and to see more fellow success stories or to support our work, you can visit ventureforamerica.org. I've been involved with VFA since even before its inception. I actually worked across the hall in the same office as VFA founder Andrew Yang. And when he told me about it, I jumped on board immediately. I even jumped in his arms. Andrew's a big hugger, so we hugged it out. And I wish that VFA had been around when I graduated. Instead, I launched my own business, the Mission Driven Group. Check out our four brands at missiondrivengroup.com. And please remember to subscribe and to like our show on iTunes. If you've been listening to the show for a while, take 5 minutes, like it. It'll help us sustain our audience. You can follow me personally at Jeremy Scheinwald on Twitter. I'm a low volume tweeter. Maybe that's a good thing for you. Today, our guest is Sarah Kaus, who decommoditized the water bottle, making it a high-end accessory. Of all things, Sarah and I interned together at JP Morgan. I haven't seen her in 14 years. At the time, Sarah was an intern by way of Harvard Business School, that is at JP Morgan. When she graduated, she worked as a producer at Tapestry Networks and then in real estate private equity before launching Swell. As you'll hear, Swell became a phenomena. It was quickly made one of Oprah's favorite things. It was made on Oprah's like summer hot list, I think. And it's been experiencing year-over-year growth of 400%. She started with an order of 3,000. She now sells 5 million bottles each year in 35 countries and growing. She has a partnership with Starbucks. She's been featured in one of Fortune's 40 Under 40. She's Department of State global mentor and so much more. We're so thrilled to have Sarah Kaus on the show today. But before we begin, I should ask you, do you need a website? Why not do it yourself with Wix.com? No matter what business you're in, you can get your site live today. It's simple to customize. If you don't know how to code, not a problem. There's no coding needed. Most entrepreneurs will tell you that developing a good web presence is essential to getting your business off the ground and acquiring new customers. If you have a new idea or just need to upgrade your website, check out Wix.com. You can go to Wix.com, that's W-I-X.com, and sign up for an entirely free account today. No credit card required. Go to W-I-X.com today. And now, here's my interview with Sarah Kaus.
Welcome to Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Building things can be really hard, and entrepreneurship is often portrayed in the media as the sexy or even worse, easy career path. Through this series, we plan to pull back the curtain and tell the gritty stories of entrepreneurship. We're striving to create a relaxed environment where entrepreneurs feel free to tell their stories.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Sarah, thanks for stopping by.
Sure.
This is quite the coincidence. I haven't seen you in quite some time. You look identical. As I was doing my research, I was like, I know this person from somewhere. I know this person. And finally it clicked. We interned together at JP Morgan.
Small world. A long time ago.
That was like the summer of Enron and WorldCom and Martha Stewart and every other disaster. And I think my group at JP Morgan made it clear to me on day one. They're like, yeah, have a good time. We're not hiring anyone. So, you know, you're not going to get hired this summer. So good luck. It was a tough summer.
It was a rough summer, but we bonded. We got through it.
And they say a lot of entrepreneurship comes during down periods because people don't see another big payday coming. So maybe that's where we both got the realized that we'd be entrepreneurs one day.
We will owe it all to that summer.
Yeah, exactly. So actually that does lead me to what I think is a good first question, which is, you started your career as an entrepreneur fairly deep into your career. You know, you'd done these stints in audit and did some time in real estate. And, I'm curious if you like had these ideas gnawing at you all this time. You're like, yeah, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll do that. And like, ideas didn't pass the cut, didn't make the cut, or you know, whether it was just like, boom, swell, this is it, I know it, it's love at first sight, I got to do this.
I think it's a bit of both. I always wanted to do something entrepreneurial, but I never had the idea. I never had something I was so passionate or felt so strongly about. But I was pretty lucky when I was actually started my career at Ernst & Young, which is now EY. I was lucky enough to work with a lot of entrepreneurs, so I think I got the bug early, but I never had the idea. So, yeah, I think it was a little bit of both.
And going back to audit, like I imagine you said you worked with a lot of entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. and you're getting pretty deep into people's numbers and seeing the good and the bad and stuff like that. Like, do you still have the heart of an auditor when you're looking at your own company today? Were there a lot of lessons?
I do. I drive my controller nuts. you can't never really take the auditor out of the person. But no, it was really great for me because I sort of learned how businesses were built and how sort of the numbers really roll up to make the whole business. But audit, I think, gets sort of a bad rap. I mean, you really do get to sort of see a lot of different businesses and industries, and it's not the most creative career, but it is interesting just because you get to see so many different things. But I still probably do have the heart of an auditor, unfortunately.
Yeah, which also might just be the heart of a real operator, like someone who's really thinking holistically about the business. So that's a pro.
Yeah, I'd like to think so.
Yeah, I'm giving you the pro audit.
Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the last person who could be an auditor, but why not? Why not defend it for you? So you went to HBS, and you've got a ton of amazing publicity out there for yourself and for Swell. You told Entrepreneur Magazine, quote, "When I left Harvard, I don't know that I would have had the confidence to start my own business in the way that I did now. I think I would have been more apologetic about it." I think the common view, we've had a whole bunch of HBS entrepreneurs on the show, actually, of HBS that develops these like bold, risk-taking, leaders. You know, Michael Bloomberg, who walked away from, millions to start at Solomon to start his own business. It's, one of the wealthiest people in the world is just an example. Like, what was missing for you? What did you feel like you... Why didn't you feel more bold when you finished up at HBS?
I think part of it is because HBS really relies on the case study method. So I think over the 2 years I was there, we read 600 cases, and not all of them were wild success stories. I think I was humbled by the cases of the stories of the entrepreneurs that things maybe weren't a wild success. So I think I was cautious in believing that I had all of the answers and all of the ideas straight out of business school. I also realized that I graduated with a significant amount of debt and with some really amazing other students and friends in my class. And I didn't want to start out the gate doing something entrepreneurial that maybe I didn't feel ready for, or maybe it wasn't going to be successful, not because my friends would judge me, but maybe I would judge myself if I didn't get it right the first time.
Well, the student debt is actually that's a real encumbrance that prevents people from taking that leap. So I certainly understand that. Mm-hmm. So what changed in the 7 years between HBS and Swell? Like, what made you believe that you were ready, kind of without those apologies?
I think I just grew up. I think I was a late bloomer. It took me some time. I did commercial real estate for a number of years. I did consulting for a few years. I had the opportunity to really be entrepreneurial in a different setting. So I got to, set up small businesses every time I did a different real estate project. I got to think about, building a team, building a P&L, figuring out what I knew and I didn't know, how to hire consultants, how to get an office, how to figure things out. I was doing a lot of international projects. So I think think I really grew up as a business person and as a businesswoman in those jobs, and I think I really found my voice. I just needed a little bit more time, I think, and experience before I felt ready to say, okay, now is the time for me to start my business. And quite frankly, I didn't have the idea coming out of business school either. So I think I sort of needed the universe to kind of send me a sign.
Actually, man, that's a good leaping off point. Tell me the founding myth or actual story. You know, starting Swell. And just give us the foundation that gave you the aha moment.
Sure. So I went to Boulder, University of Colorado at Boulder for undergrad.
I actually have a dog named Boulder because my wife went to Boulder.
Oh, that's great. I love that dog.
Yeah.
So cute. So I went to Boulder for undergrad. I can't say I was a tree hugger, but I was always a bit of an environmentalist. And so I never used the plastic bottles. Everywhere I went, my whole, you know, college career, all the way through, you know, being an auditor, business school, working in real estate, I always carried a water bottle everywhere I went. But it was never something that was fashionable. It never really fit my lifestyle. I would use it and then put it back away, and I wouldn't leave it out on the table like I have in front of me now. I mean, it was always just sort of something that I hid. So I had sort of an idea about creating a fashionable water bottle, but thinking about myself as the consumer. And then I happened to go hiking in Arizona with my mom. My mom had just gotten over breast cancer, and she was incredibly reflective about her life, and she asked me these questions about, you know, what would you do if you could do something else? You know, maybe if you didn't do a corporate career, if you were going to start your own business, like you've spoken about before in the past, what would you do? And I immediately said I would create this fashionable water bottle company. So I sort of think the idea was always in the back of my mind, but I needed to really be poised the question head on to say, this is definitively what I'd like to do with my career.
And you mentioned your mom, like your parents were small business people. Did that make you more or less inclined to take a risk?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably less inclined. I mean, I know how hard my parents worked, but I think my parents were very successful as small business people. I mean, they achieved incredible balance. They were always home for dinner, and we took vacations every year, and they didn't get consumed by their business. But at the same time, I saw how difficult it was on sort of a daily basis for them. But, you know, I think my parents being entrepreneurs themselves, I think I was more open to taking the plunge into starting Swell because I knew they wouldn't judge me. You know, I think, you know, leaving a job with a great title and, you know, beautiful business card and a benefits package, I think sometimes parents can be a little concerned. So I think my parents were more flexible with me because they had also taken that plunge in their lives.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I couldn't agree more. Like, I always say that the toughest part for me in starting my own business was getting over telling my parents. And they, you know, I could have been a banker or whatever it was.
And that makes them feel comfortable, you
yeah.
know? Like, oh, I'm not worried about him because he does this thing I understand.
Yeah, and yeah. It's like, it's secure, and we worked hard to get him this, you know, make sure he can get this education, and now it's like, could be out the window. Will he ever get back on track if this thing falls apart? So I think that's something that, like, a lot of people think that money is the biggest obstacle, and sometimes it can be, but I think that entrepreneurs need a lot of support, even though I think people think of us all as like gunslingers who are like, you know, it's me against the world. But I think that support network is crucial.
Yeah, I finally got comfortable telling people I was starting a water bottle company, and I went to an HBS wedding, and one of my really good friends heard me introducing myself to a stranger. Oh, I'm Sarah. I'm starting this water bottle company. And she jumped in the conversation and said, but she used to have a really important job.
Oh.
She felt the need to tell a stranger that I was a good person because I used to be a vice president somewhere. And it's funny that you don't always have that support exactly when you need it.
Right. She was well-meaning and saying that
defensively.
She has a
really big heart. She's a good friend, but she just didn't want another person to think I was this flaky person.
Yeah. I think I'm going to ask questions around that because I know some people who had that experience as well. And even me, I felt a little apologetic for a while.
Yeah.
I remember one of my, when I started my business, I think one of my parents' friends kind of, like, they kept saying to me, like, are you still doing that thing?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah.
Like,
I've got six employees at the time or whatever it was. It's like, yeah, you're doing it full time.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, I've got like 50 people on staff and I'm like, you know, the middle child in me wants to call and be like, you know, I'm okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting, the role that ego played. And then, I mean, similarly, you talked about how your grandfather used to joke around. I read this. Your grandfather used to joke around that like, why don't you sell the water in the bottles?
He never understood. Yeah. And God bless him. I wish he was still alive because I wish I could show him, you know, one of our, you know, the article in Fortune magazine or, you know, something to say, look, we made it. But he always just thought if you put water in the bottle that people would buy them. He just never really got the whole reusable bottle thing. But funny enough, my grandmother now has purchased one because everyone in her bridge club has a Swell bottle. So she went to the store and bought one. And I thought, you know, you have a cupboard of them at home. But it's very sweet. So I think he'd get it now. But at the time, it went right over his head.
That is very sweet. Yeah. Tell me if I'm getting this wrong, but you kind of started with a little. How long did it take you between having this epiphany and actually, you know, being in business, like sourcing the product, selling it online?
I would say it took probably six to 9 months. We had, you know, first proto samples in about 6 months, and then another 3 months or so, you know, setting up the website and actually shipping out the product.
And did you have like 1 foot in the business, or was it 2 feet in the business from the start?
It was 2 feet from the start. I tend to throw myself into things 100%, and I realized that I couldn't be doing that at my corporate job and then also give what I needed to Swell. So I thought I would just take 6 months off and start this business and see if it was successful or not, and then either go back to real estate or stay with Swell. But, you know, 6 months in, I still hadn't sold anything, so I really needed to commit to staying a little longer. Yeah.
Did you ask for a leave, or you said, like, look, I'm pulling the cord, I'm out of here?
No, I left. I mean, yeah. I was still sort of looking at, you know, opportunities on the side, not really interviewing, but just sort of talking to people. And it was a bit challenging because I was actually offered a job during that time, and it was being a managing director of a new real estate company. And I accepted the job, and then 2 days later I said, you know, I can't. I have this thing that I'm doing on the side. And I think because of that opportunity and I had turned it down, it really pushed me to say, okay, Swell really needs to be something important, because I just turned down something pretty awesome
right
here. So, but I just know myself. I couldn't possibly do two jobs at the same time.
So when you were doing this, like just you, sole founder, mm-hmm. You know, you quit your real estate job, sole founder. Tell me about the accountability. Like, did you say to yourself, like, I need to be, did you have a whole bunch of milestones, you know, for the next 6 months? I need to have a website here. I need to have sales going by then. Mm-hmm. Or was it just like, wake up every day and just do it?
Really both. I mean, I did set milestones. I did write some goals. And interestingly enough, like almost everything I put down and, you know, what I wanted to accomplish that first year, we've done. I mean, a lot of it took a lot longer than a year. You know, I said I wanted to do the bottles for the TED conference and for Fashion Week and be the only bottle in Bloomingdale's. And we've done all those things.
Sure, this is what you, this was in your initial
set of
goals. In
my initial, like I wrote my 3-page business plan. I'm like, we are going to be this. Of course, a lot of that took a lot longer than I had ever anticipated, and it was more challenging. But I never said, you know, I ordered 3,000 bottles the first year. You know, last year we sold 5 million bottles. 3,000 bottles, because that was the factory minimum. And that's how many would fit in my apartment. And I put them under my kitchen table, and I hid them with a, you know, a beautiful tablecloth so I could still have people over and it didn't look like inventory. So, I had a goal of selling those 3,000 bottles so I could order more, but I didn't make myself crazy in saying, you know, I need to be a millionaire this year or something like that. I just,
right.
Because I didn't raise money. I didn't have someone sort of breathing down my neck that I had to hit certain milestones. But in my own mind, I thought, if this isn't successful, then I really should be doing something else with my time.
I hope everyone who was listening just heard me go breathless on that one where you said it went from 3,000 to 5 million. I went like, whoa, or something like that. I mean, that is incredible. I don't know what to say. So you started as a bootstrapper, and you had, maybe you're still a bootstrapper. You are still a bootstrapper from the nod of your head that people can't see.
Yeah.
So you start with like $30,000. Is that, what did the $30,000 get you?
So inventory. You know, I basically had to set up a factory and molds and figuring out the manufacturing line and buy the first inventory. But I also had to set up a website. So I worked with sort of a branding agency that helped me set up the website. You know, box of business cards, you know, some press kits. I was pretty scrappy, and I didn't hire anyone for the first couple of years, so I didn't have to, you know, pay myself a salary. So I really only invested in what I had to.
So you didn't say you didn't hire anyone for the first couple of years. It was just you, mm-hmm. the site, manufacturing outsourced, mm-hmm. and until like how many, I don't know if you can share this, but I mean, how many bottles are you selling when you finally hire your first person?
That's a good question. So I hired my first person, I think two years in, and she's still with us today. She's our director of marketing, partnerships, and public relations. She really wore a lot of hats, but she was her first job right out of college. So she's really grown with the business, and we've grown with her. And now we're up to maybe 45 employees in New York.
Right.
But, you know, in those early days, the type of stores that we were in, it was manageable for me to do it myself. So
right.
The first year I went to 17 trade shows, you know, stood in a booth, talked about the product. It was pretty much staying with, you know, business school friends on their couches. You know, come back home at night and then enter all the orders, charge the credit cards. I was doing customer service for the e-com, for the .com. So, and then, you know, get up the next morning and go to the next trade show. So the first year it was manageable because the types of stores we were in were just sort of boutiques, you know, specialty one-off mom and pop stores. It wasn't as challenging as, you know, working with big box stores.
I think you have a lot of accolades in your career, but I'm going to give you, like, I think you're the scrappiest entrepreneur we've had on the show. That's amazing. Like, you were sleeping, because, I mean, so much of the show is dedicated to, like, debunking the myths of entrepreneurship, and here you are, you know, a couple years in or whatever, you know, a year and a half in, whatever it was, your product has become a success, and you're still, like, sleeping on people's couches, doing all the, you know, customer service yourself, sales one-to-one. I mean, that's amazing. Yes. Is there a story of deprivation here? Like, I'm always curious about the things that people... Like, when I started my business, I mean, it was a different world. Like, it wasn't a smartphone world, but I actually cut off my cell phone because I was like, I'm going to have my office phone, and I'll be there all the time. I don't need the extra expense of a cell phone, and I, like, reduced my personal rent, and, like, I was the same thing as you. I was a bootstrapper, and I kind of, it's like every single personal expense I can reduce is... you know, is more money that I can leave in the business and do fun things and interesting things with. So I'm curious if you had any, like, what some of the personal sacrifices you made were.
Well, I mean,
aside from, you know, putting your own money in the company.
New York apartments aren't huge, so I think the biggest sacrifice was probably just space. You know, until I had that first employee, I didn't have an office, so it was a lot of, you know, sort of giving up space more than anything else. I'm not really a big spender or shopper, but, you know, doing a consumer products company that's inventory based is, you know, we were cash flow positive from the beginning. And, you know, we do have healthy margins, and, you know, our customers did buy and appreciate the product. So I was lucky there. But I always had to continue to invest in inventory as we grew. And, you know, buying inventory from China and storing it, selling it, and then collecting on it, there's always a bit of a cycle there,
right.
Especially in as we grow really fast, you had to keep buying more and more inventory to finance the growth. So there's always been some deprivation, you know, the deprivation, because there's never been a ton of capital in the business, which means there was never really enough left over to pay myself a salary for the first few years. So.
I mean, I think you just answered this, but, like, the $30,000 is all you need. You never, like, dipped into credit cards or went beyond that. You were cash flow positive from day one.
That's true, yeah.
That's incredible. And so, you know, we've talked about audit before from like, a helping your business perspective, but also, like, you know, not a lot about audit. We sort of joked about, like, not sort of thought of as being that entrepreneurial creative, but, like, you know, then there's design, which is kind of a diametrically opposed skill. How do you design the first water bottle? I mean, was it your own design? Did you bring out a bunch of industrial designers?
So I had a bunch of friends from business school, and we did the crazy summer Hamptons house share, where you rent a house, you know, two people sign the lease, and really 50 people stay there over the course of the summer. And you have an Excel spreadsheet that says what weekends people can come out. And so I had a really good group of friends that were working in fashion and marketing and merchandising, banking. And we got together every weekend, and, you know, every other weekend sometimes. And I brought out my designs. And my first designs for Swell were in PowerPoint, because I didn't have any skills of, you know, how to use any of these, you know, 3D printing programs. So we drew the first bottles and then said, you know, what does this look like to you? So my focus group is really my friends. And then from there, I started working with a few different factories and started getting proto samples. And then I would bring them out and show my friends and say, would you use this? How would you use this? Could you take it on a bike ride? Could you take it golfing? Why don't you take this to the office? So it was really non-traditional, but that's sort of the friend group that I had and the budget that I had at the time. But it really just needed to feel like hip New Yorkers would like to use the product, and then I thought other people would embrace it as well.
Were there a bunch of radically different designs, and finally you were like, ah, that's the one, I can see it?
I think we got a little too fancy in the beginning. I mean, the Swell bottle is really elegant because it doesn't have any bells and whistles. It doesn't have a carabiner. It doesn't have a hook. It doesn't have a filter. It's just a bottle. And so we let go a lot of the, you know, when you ask for opinions, people will say, oh, I would only use this if it had a blah, blah, blah. So I added a lot in based upon the initial feedback of my friends. But really what felt right to me was to do something that was very like classic and functional. I had the idea in my head that I really wanted to be something that would be featured and sold in the MoMA store. And we are now. Funny enough, they actually spelled my name wrong the first time I went to go see the swell in the MoMA store. But it's corrected now. But I wanted to be that elegant, classic design. And with that vision, I knew that we couldn't have lots of bells and whistles. So, I mean, some of the early designs weren't as elegant as where we wound up.
And you know, in terms of you finally have this design, mm-hmm. and you're manufacturing in China. How does one find I'm sure there are many, many factories where they could make this for you. But how do you find the right one? How do you feel comfortable with one?
I went there a lot. I had this goal of creating a water bottle company because I wanted to get plastic out of the environment. And, I learned about the water crisis early on. So I always wanted to work with, charities that were providing clean drinking water to people in need. So I had this mission of making the world a better place. So with that in my heart, I couldn't very well work at the factory that had any type of, environmental pollutants or any type of issues. And, you read these articles and you hear these scare stories about how, big corporations don't always know end-to-end manufacturing and what happens there. So I personally needed to spend a lot of time thinking about not only the quality of the product, but the quality of the manufacturing environment. But I was lucky enough that I had some friends from school, and I took a lot of people out to lunch and coffees and said, can I just pick your brain? And, I found people that, had relatives in manufacturing and, realized that there's a lot of really good, rich information on the web. And but nothing beats just going over there. And so I think the first time I went, I visited five or six different factories, and I wound up picking the one that had the highest quality but also the highest cost. We're still working with that same factory today. We've added three more, but it was certainly the most challenging piece of the whole puzzle when I was starting out.
And you're there and you get comfortable, and there's like still a leap between getting comfortable and like actually making that first order of 3,000 water bottles. And when you made that order, were you just kind of like holding your breath?
I was so nervous. I was so nervous. It's one thing to see the proto sample. It's a completely different thing when the bottles came. And of course they sent me a picture of all the cartons after they had been made. And I thought I had worked out just how much space, 3,000. And I thought, oh my God, it was already on the boat. It was on the way. And they'd sent me a picture and said, here it is. It's on the way. And I thought, oh, this is not going to fit my apartment. But I was also really nervous and kind of excited when I opened the box the first time. Of course, I lived in a doorman building in New York, and I had to like sneak everything upstairs because you're not supposed to be running a business out of your apartment. But it was very nerve-wracking to get that first order delivered.
And did you have any pre-sales at all? Or was it like, okay, I got 3,000 here and let's hit the pavement?
No, I had some pre-sales. So I launched a Facebook page. And of course, it's mostly like friends and family that that started to do the orders. I think I took the orders about 2 or 3 months before the products actually arrived. And then I did all the PR myself. So I started writing to different magazines and different blogs. And, I remember being very excited the first time someone made a purchase that I didn't recognize their name. And I had a little box, how'd you hear about us? And they'd write the name of the blog. And then I'd write to the blogger and say, thank you so much. I sold one bottle based upon, you have to start somewhere. I did have, I think, about 400 bottles I had pre-sold before they arrived.
And so, you're talking about this, like, building this up one-to-one, kind of sales even. How did you know, how quickly to sell to 3,000? How did you know that swell would swell?
That's a good question. I don't think I always had the confidence in my heart that it was possible. I think we had sold through about half of the first order when I then had to order more, and it's kind of an interesting story. So I sent a bottle to Oprah's magazine, to the editor, and I put it in a box, said editor Oprah, Chicago, Illinois, put it in a box and sent it on the way. And I put my press kit in the box, and I got a call from the editor and said, hey, I just got back from a family vacation in Peru. I took this thing, loved it. It really works, and I like your story. I'd love to put it in the magazine. Send me one of every color you have.
Thank God.
And I only had them in blue. They only came in blue. That's all I had. And so I explained that to her. I said, they only come in blue. And she said, well, that's great. when you have colors someday, call us back because you really need colors to look great in a magazine. So at that point, I had to make the decision, am I going to buy the minimums for 3,000? Am I going to buy 3,000 each of six new colors? And at that point, I'm going to have to set up a warehouse. And at that point, I'm going to have to really get my stuff together. So I think that was sort of the crystallizing moment of, okay, somebody in the universe is potentially giving me a sign that there's some love for this product out there. So I did order more.
But I mean, is that a no-brainer when Oprah calls you? You make those bottles, right?
Well, I did make them, but I guess there was no guarantee that they were actually going to make it into the magazine. But a few months later, we did make it in.
And was it one of Oprah's favorite things? Am I getting that wrong?
Oh, it was one of her. It was on the O list, which is her must have list.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was must have list for summer 2011.
So what does that do? And, you were aware that it was going to make the list. They told you in advance.
They did. They called me and then let me know it was going to make it, so I could get ready.
Did they give you any expectation for what to expect?
No expectation at all. It was exciting. The website sales definitely. There is an Oprah effect. Absolutely, the website sales were robust, and the few stores we were in at the time were quite pleased. But really, more than anything, it was a couple things. My mom was very proud. I think she was more proud of Oprah than business school for me. I mean, this was a big deal. But more importantly, I think it was a stamp of confidence and credibility that I could then go to other stores and say, look, we were featured in this magazine. It's something you must have for summer.
Right.
And it wasn't just, Sarah saying Swell was great, but it was, this authority on all things saying Swell was great. So it really did help more on the future distribution than on current sales.
And, I think it's like the market just telling you something, right? The market saying the market is saying we want this in many different colors, mm-hmm. and we need this. I think that's like the best way to just to follow the market. That's mm-hmm. amazing. When was the first time that you saw someone, just a random stranger, carrying your bottle, and what was your reaction?
Oh, I mean, I just got so excited.
How far into your production was it?
That's a good question. It was probably in the second year. I had a really funny week, actually. I saw three Swells out in the wild in the same week. The first one in Central Park, then I saw one on the subway, and then I saw someone filling up in an airport. And I have to say, it bent my mind. I didn't even know the people. Of course, I had to talk to them. I had to say something like, oh, hey, I like your water bottle. And the guy on the subway, he had a green bottle, and he said, oh, yeah, and it gives back to charity. It was neat to hear what these customers bought the product for and what they thought of. And of course, I had to tell them it was my company.
Right.
But yeah, I remember that week being really memorable.
That's interesting, because you remember that as they give back, and it's like this individual who's, he's not just like, oh yeah, it's a water bottle I picked up off the shelf. Like, he clearly understood the brand,
right.
Which is amazing.
Right.
The bottles range, I think it was on the site, about $20 to about $130 right now.
Well, they're more like $25 to $45, but we have done some special bottles. Like, we did a couple of years ago for World Water Day, we did a $100 bottle that gave water for life, but all the money went back to charity. But typically, they're $35 is the most common price point.
So, what made you think that the market could handle that? Like, did you do a whole bunch of surveys and stuff like that? It was just like, I'm putting a finger in the air so that no one can see. Like, this is my price point. I feel good about this.
No, I felt pretty good about the price point. I mean, the bottles are quite expensive to manufacture, because there's really two bottles. There's one on the outside that you see and one on the inside that you don't see. It's sort of double-walled stainless. So when you pick up the bottle, it weighs a pound. It's a substantial piece of hardware. And I wanted customers to really think about the product differently and to realize it's a luxury product and really... I wanted to be able to make sure that the margins were there to really support the nonprofit piece that we work with, too. So there was some math and specialness that went into coming up with the price point, but I have to say it was sort of more of a gut feeling, looking at what other bottles were in the market and just sort of wanting to be on the luxury side of that.
So I'm not a luxury water bottle shopper, but I am always, I always try and support the people who are on the show, so I'm gonna go and buy one. But were you the only one then? I mean, are there others I think there are others that have sprung up since then?
Well, there's other great water bottles, and I have to say, if I'd much rather have any customer buy any reusable water bottle than be using the plastic disposable bottle. So I'm not as precious about that. But I have to say, Swell was really the first fashion forward. We say it's a fashionable hydration accessory, but Swell was really the first bottle that we we think about ourselves as a fashion accessory. We come out with new collections twice a year, just like a fashion brand. So we do spring, summer, fall, holiday. We do a lot of designer collaborations. We work with fashion designers. We look at trends. We look at what's going on in fashion. And so we really think about ourselves differently. Where other water bottles, they might just come out with 5 or 10 colors, and for 100 years, those are the colors that they're going to make. But we really think about ourselves a little bit differently.
I want to tell you about Kevin Gowan Sr., who, realizing that accounts receivable financing was a growing industry, saw that it was just missing a few key components. Kevin founded AmeriFactors Financial Group, LLC, in 1990 with a focus on professionalism, expert customer service, and a drive to take the success of your business personally. They've been in business for 20 years and have funded over $5 billion, that's right, billion dollars, two businesses. With AmeriFactors, you can stop waiting 30, 60, or 90 days to get paid on invoices. You can turn your invoices into immediate working capital through factoring. Factoring isn't a loan, and there's nothing to pay back. You can use the funds to make payroll, hire new staff, buy equipment, or go after new customers. AmeriFactors may be a financial service provider, but they're so much more than that. They're your business partner. Go to www.amerifactors.com or call 1-800-844-FUND. That's 1-800-844-FUND. The $600 application fee will be waived if you mention the Smart People Should Build Things podcast when you call.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
So it's really hard to argue with the trajectory you've had. I keep sort of shaking my head about this, about the 3,000 to 5 million bottles. Can you look back and say, hey, there's something I just should have done differently?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have to say there's so many things I could have done better. I wish I had hired a team sooner. We have such a strong, committed, passionate team here in New York City, and now we've got a few employees overseas. We have got someone in London, some in Hong Kong, some in China. I see how much easier my life is and how much more successful the company is because we have a team, and I wish I hadn't been so stubborn thinking I should do everything myself in those early days.
We're talking to Sarah Kaus, who's a bootstrapping entrepreneur, and she's already talked a little bit about how I think she just did. She just said that she was very cost conscious at the beginning and could have let it go. But I think that's true of all entrepreneurs, all bootstrappers at least. And I think one of the ways to keep costs down is to do your website yourself. Sarah, did you do your website yourself, your first one?
Actually, I hired someone to do the first website, and then the second website I did myself. And now
the third one,
we have a really great internal team that did the site.
So. Interesting. Yeah. So if you want to do it yourself, maybe consider doing it with Wix.com. And no matter what business you're in, you can get your site live today. It's simple to customize. Don't know how to code? No problem. There's no coding needed. Most entrepreneurs will tell you that developing good web presence is essential to get your business off the ground and acquiring new customers. If you have a new idea or just need to upgrade your website, check out Wix.com. You can go to Wix.com and sign up for an entirely free account today. No credit card required. Go to Wix.com today. Okay, so we were talking about the kind of mistakes and setbacks and this amazing growth trajectory. You wrote about how you, I think I'm not sure if this was in the past or now. I mean, you said you've kind of offloaded some of your responsibilities to others, but you wrote about how you had no work-life balance, which I think is true of a lot of entrepreneurs. But is there, clearly it's a successful business. I mean, is there any temptation at this point to say, well, I could just sell this thing and I could, get all of my life balance back at this point?
I've been lucky. Lots of investors have come knocking and they're interested, and we've got some people that are really passionate about the brand. But we don't need the capital at this point, and there's still so much that I really want to do at Swell that I can't imagine doing anything other than what I'm doing now. I mean, of course, I'd love to do a little less of it, maybe start taking some more weekends off and, maybe not as many hours in the office. But I love what I do, and I just can't imagine not being in the middle of it. I mean, the first few years were so incredibly difficult, and things are still, challenging right now, managing the growth and making sure the culture stays the same as we grow, and, making sure that the team feels supported and we have the right product at the right place. There's lots of challenges every day, but there's so much more fun to deal with in the early days of just not really knowing if things were going to work out. So, so yes, I mean, I'm every so often, you know, get some interesting letters and calls, but I, at this point, I can't imagine doing anything other than what I'm doing right now.
But your work life still tilts way towards work at this point.
Way towards work. I have issues. I took last weekend off, and it was really nice. And we do a standing team meeting every Monday. And I told everybody at the team meeting that everyone's to take weekends off. It's really amazing. Changed my life. No, it is really, I think, important to have some balance. And
Did you actually take the weekend off, or were you like in the park checking your emails?
No, I actually went back to the fancy spa in Arizona where I originally wrote the first business plan for Swell with my mom. So it sort of went back to Swell's birthplace this weekend. And it was neat because maybe half the people at the spa were using Swell bottles, and they sell them there in the gift shop now. So even though I didn't work, I did talk to a lot of people about the product while I was there.
This is one of my questions that I always love asking, which is because like I still check our revenue probably, I don't know, every hour or something like that. I can't help it. Whenever I have a second, I'm like, oh, how do we have any sales today? Are you a compulsive revenue checker? Are you able to just kind of like how much do you get to report every day of sales, or is it every week that you look? How do
you know, I out? Actually I'm still leading up the sales team, so I run a sales meeting once a week. On Tuesday, so I do take a look at the numbers on Tuesdays, but I do confess I have an app on my phone that tracks .com revenue, but I really look at that more just to make sure, you know, things are going well, and, you know, we get a lot of press and PR, so I'm always interested to see what leads to conversions, so I'm not obsessive about it, but I probably do look at the, you know, Google Analytics app once a day or something just to see where things are going. But it's probably more like once a week. I just want to check out where we are.
Once a week. I think that's actually hugely restrained and impressive.
There's too many other things to look at every minute. So
That's the Jeremy question. My favorite Andrew Yang question, the founder of VFA, he always talks about how people shape businesses, but businesses also shape people and their personalities. And can you talk about how you know, how Swell has changed you as a person? Hmm. And everyone always goes, that's a good question.
That's a really good question. You know, I think Swell has really changed me in a positive way. You know, I think it's the first time I'm leading a team. You know, it's the first time that I'm responsible for, you know, 45 people when they come to work every day. And I need to make sure that they're feeling supported in their career and that they're working in a culture that that they feel positive about and that they're excited about the product and what's going on. So I think it's made me really conscious of you know, being a leader and how my thoughts and my actions and my words in the office sort of reflect upon how everybody feels about their careers. I spend a lot of time thinking about the team and how people can grow with us as we grow. And it's hard to always make the time to do that because I'm still wearing a lot of hats. I'm still working in the business, not necessarily on the business. I'm trying to get better about that. But I really do try to meet with as many people as much as I can to really think about being a leader. I mean, I've always been more of a doer in all of my past careers. I've never been this leader of the company, but I know, like, even, you know, being on a podcast like this or you know, winning an award or going to, it means a lot to the team, even though I personally would be much happier just sitting at my desk doing emails than like going doing these things. I'm incredibly uncomfortable doing those things, but I know that it means something to the team because they feel like they're part of something else. So I really have to think about, you know, myself as a leader, and I think Swell has really pushed me in ways that I never thought I would be comfortable.
You talked about culture. I'm curious how you created a culture, how a culture was created. I think some of culture just creates itself. Mm-hmm. But what's the culture at Swell, and how are you fostering it?
You know, I really wanted to create a happy place. You know, I've worked in many different types of environments, and not to say they weren't happy, but I wanted to create a place that people would feel excited and energized about coming to work every day. And I think you're right. I mean, I think the culture does sort of create itself in a way. And I think, you know, working in a startup that's growing really fast and it's getting lots of attention, I think that really helps create a positive place to work. because we also have grown really fast, it's given people within the company the opportunity to wear many hats or to work on different projects. And a lot of people that have come to work at Swell have come from bigger companies that maybe they were very siloed in their career, and maybe they wouldn't get to work on, you know, many different things. And I think that that really does contribute to happiness at work. And you know, I try to be supportive of making sure that, you know, someone might know, yes, you're in the design team or you're in sales or you're in production, but if there are things that are going on within the company, like, you know, picking the new colors for the new collection, or, you know, giving us insight into the types of collaborations we should do, or, you know, there are certain types of meetings that, regardless of who you are in the company, you can still get involved in. And then I do a lot. I really try to do a lot to keep things like fun in the office. Like, we do a happy hour every week. We built out a pretty cool roof deck that people can have lunch outside. We do a team building event like once a quarter. We have pretty fun like fitness competitions. So we do the bottles for Equinox, the sports club. So mm-hmm. I buy everybody a fitness membership at Equinox. And a lot of people go to, you know, spin class after work together. And people at Swell work really hard, but I wanted to create a place that they felt that could be a little bit fun too.
So we talked a moment ago about you taking your foot off the gas potentially, and you said no way, there's just too much to work on. So you know, I mean, I don't want anything too proprietary, but what's left? I mean, what does the future hold?
Oh, great question. So we actually just launched a new line of bottles called Sip by Swell, and they came out April 1st at Target. So Target put us in 1,800 stores on an end cap.
Wow.
And they were nice enough to buy the product before they had seen it, but they were so excited about Swell, and we told them about Sip. And so Sip by Swell is sort of a pretty hip little bottle for the mass market. It's $24.99, so it's an easier price point and has really playful and fun colors, and it's more style and fashion. And then after the six-month exclusive with Target, we're going to start rolling that out to the mass market, and we think that Sip has the potential to be just as big as well. But then in addition to Sip, we actually just last month kicked off a five-year innovation roadmap of new products. So we're hearing from our customers that they love Swell, and now they love Sip, and they want to know what else we have. So we're working on a whole bunch of different ideas. Some are really close in, and, you know, in the beverage space, you know, for, you know, coffee, tea, you know, wide mouth, ice cubes. And then there's some that are really far out, and they're more sort of technology types of situations. But it's fun because we did grow pretty slowly and pretty carefully. I think we are lucky that we have a brand that now customers are looking towards to bring other products.
Last question: to tell us about the charitable component of it, because I mean, you're that is part of the brand. I mean, you said that individual, the first individual who you talked to in an airport, brought it up.
Yeah.
So tell us about the impact you're having there.
Yeah. So actually, I went to my 5-year reunion for business school, and I went to a presentation about climate change, and they talked about how climate change was only going to make the water crisis in the world worse. So places of drought were only going to have a harder time getting access to water. So I became obsessed with this idea, and I just read as much as I could. And so ever since the beginning of Swell, we've always partnered with water charities. So we work with the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, and we support their TAP project here in North America. And we make a contribution to them, and they're kind enough to, you know, let us get involved in some other activities. So instead of having a happy hour on World Water Day, we had a tappy hour where we actually all put down our phones. And for every minute you put your phone down, a bigger donation would be made to UNICEF. But we really try to bring it into the DNA of what we do at Swell, but we also educate our customers about what, you know, the good work that UNICEF does around water. And then we work with all different types of charities throughout the year. A fun one is we work with American Forest. So we have a bottle that looks like wood, but it's actually double-walled stainless steel, but it looks so much like wood that we decided to partner with a tree charity. And every bottle we sell, American Forest plants a tree. And last year, they planted for Swell over 500,000 trees, because that's how many wood bottles we sold, which was a bit shocking. It's really fun because we get to pick where the trees go. So 20,000 of them went in my hometown where I went to Girl Scout camp and there was a fire. But we've also planted trees in Mexico where the monarch butterflies do
migration,
thank you, whatever that word is. We also did some elk restoration habitats in Minnesota, which is really fun. And then every so often, like maybe 4 or 5 times during the year, we'll do a charity and really concentrate on it for a course of a month. So in October, we work with the Breast Cancer Research Foundation. In November, we do No Shave Movember for men's cancers. And we put a mustache on a bottle, and it always sells out. People love a mustache, men and women alike. So we really try to use use the power of the brand and share messages with our consumers about you know, nonprofits that we think that they want to care about, they should care about.
Wow, that's what a great story. I mean, it's just amazing. I'm so glad that you didn't get a job at J.P. Morgan.
Me too.
It's amazing. thanks so much. You want to throw out all the brand info, like all the site, the Instagram, the Twitter, the whatever, all
sure.
the stuff.
Sure. So if you want to find out more about Swell, it's just www.swellbottle.com. And if you want to check us out on, you know, Instagram or anywhere else, it's just @swellbottle.
Thanks so much for being here. This was awesome.
Thanks. It's been fun.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.